Welcome back to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. In this episode, I will talk about The Door into Summer by Heinlein. This is the second novel that Heinlein published in 1957, in book form at least. It was serialized in 1956, then in 1956. And this is the second adult novel that he wrote during this period of The Juveniles after Double Star. There were other novels, adult novels, that he published, but those were like reprints of or reworkings of the Astounding Stories. Oh, no, there's one more, The Puppet Masters, too. So there's three, sorry. So this would be the third of those. But there were, like, I think, like Sixth Column was published during this period as well. But that was those were things written before the war. So this is, I think it's a pretty well-known novel. I think it's like the version I have. I actually have the physical copy of this one, which is the SF Masterworks series by Golans. So it must be somewhat notable to be published as one of the SF science fiction masterworks. But anyways, this novel is... it's got a lot of beautiful moments, actually. Now, obviously, it's a cat, man and his cat kind of novel, which, Heinlein was a cat guy, which is something I appreciate about him. But let's talk about the title first, I guess. So the novel begins and ends with this concept of the door into summer. And of course, this comes from Heinlein's own experience. So this is just drawn straight from his life, as talked about in where did Heinlein talk about that? I think it's in like somewhere else he mentioned this, but I'll just read it, I guess. He's talking about the narrator, who is Davis. Daniel Boone Davis. Once again, he's throwing out this name. I assume we saw this in Time for the Stars, where we had someone like naming their kid after these kind of heroic figures in American history, kind of as a celebration of this individualism. That's a way Heinlein's identifying these people as hyper individualist American types. Now, I think it's quite complicated in this novel for reasons maybe I'll get into, but so obviously he's like one of these hyper competent characters, very much like we've seen in The Juveniles a lot. The difference being, of course, now he's an adult. Now he's got an adult character or a more mature protagonist. It's really the only difference. This could have been a juvenile quite easily, just a precocious young inventor or something. But anyways, my point about the title, The Door into Summer. So we have this, he's in this house that has like 11 doors. And this is what he writes. 12 if you count Pete's door. Pete is the cat, his cat. And the cat talks, by the way, in this novel. In the audiobook version, it's kind of a corrupted meow, but in the text, it's just like the cat's actually sort of saying words to Davis. But anyways, 12 if you count Pete's door. I've always tried to arrange a door of his own for Pete. In this case, a board fitted into a window with an unused bedroom in which I had cut a cat strainer just wide enough for Pete's whiskers. I spent too much of my life opening doors for cats. I once calculated that since the dawn of civilization, 978 man centuries have been used that way. I could show you the figures. Pete usually used his own door except when he could bully me into opening a people door for him, which he preferred. But he would not use his door when there was snow on the ground. While still a kitten, all fluff and buzzes, Pete had worked out a simple philosophy. I was in charge of the quarters, rations, and weather. He was in charge of everything else. But he held me especially responsible for weather. Connecticut winters are good only for Christmas cards. Regularly that winter, Pete would check his own door, refuse to go out because of that unpleasant white stuff beyond. He was no fool, then badgered me to open a people door. He had a fixed conviction that at least one of them must lead into summer weather. Each time this meant that I had to go around with him to each of the 11 doors, hold it open while he satisfied himself that it was winter that way too, and then go to the next door while his criticism on my mismanagement grew more bitter with each disappointment. Blah, blah, blah. He would never give up his search for the door into summer. Oh, okay. Sorry. So that's the quote. So I found it here in the Wikipedia entry for this article, is that he, this was an interview with Bester where he mentions that this is just drawn from his own life when he was in Colorado. His cat wanted him to open up the door into summer during wintertime. So that comes up again at the end of the story, because this is a story about time travel, and time travel works two ways. One is a device that allows people to go back or forward in time. The character uses it to go back. And then the deep sleep, which allows you to sleep until some point in the future. So these two things together form the plot of the novel, and we end up with sort of a deterministic universe. When he takes a deep sleep and he goes into the future, he finds that he has invented things, or at least his name is on things that he invented that he didn't remember inventing. And it turns out he did invent them just in his timeline in the future. He goes back in time and basically rectifies the timeline for what it is. For instance, the girl that he ends up marrying, he finds out she's married, and he doesn't realize at the time that she's married to him. He has to go back in time and set up the marriage with her. It's a pretty simple story that way, a little bit like By His Bootstraps. I haven't read all You Zombies yet, but I think that's similar. And I've heard Farnan's Freehold has sort of a time travel deterministic loop thing going on in it. But that's what we have here in this story. But the point is, at the end, we're told, like, the character is also looking for this door into summer. And the door into summer is the future, right? So he's encouraging people, don't go to the past, but the future for humanity is our door into summer. It's a very optimistic tale about humans' technological progress. And there's the time travel stuff is fun. It makes a really nice story. It's quite compelling. And I think that's one reason this novel is popular, because it goes down really smooth. It's really simple to accept. There's not much going on. It's kind of like Double Star in that way. I think it's one reason both these novels are fairly popular is, you know, the science fiction elements are tangential to the main story, which in Double Star, it's about an actor slipping into the life of someone else. Here, it's about someone getting revenge on business partners who betrayed him. The thing about Ricky, we'll talk about at some point later on, because I think that's an issue in the novel, maybe. I'm not sure it's been, it's not really talked about in the Wikipedia article that much. I'll just sort of set it up. He's got this, basically, the stepdaughter of his business partner, Miles. Frederica. She's a girl. She's young. And he builds up a friendship with her. He goes into the future and finds out about her that she's also went into deep sleep, and that's why. So she's only like 20. She's quite young still, but she's an adult now. And he kind of like finishes falling in love with her. It's sort of implied he's been in love with her. Goes back in time and talks to her and sets up that. You're going to go in, when you're old enough, you're going to go into the cold sleep and come out 20 and marry me. So he's getting engaged to a girl who's under age. But you can kind of look at it as a betrothal. And I think those happen enough in history. I don't know. I was thinking when I read this, it's like maybe when I'm done with this series, I should make a top 10 list of the top 10 cringy moments in Heinlein's fiction. And this would have to be on that list in some way, right? There's something a little bit off about this. You can't really pin him down as at worst, he's like arranging a marriage with someone who's underage for when she's older. But it's a little sussy, I suppose. But maybe I'll talk about it a little bit later on what to make of it. Now I lost my train of thought a little bit. All right. Last thing, door into summer. So the theme of door into summer is this future that is going to be bright for humanity through technology. It's a very GE kind of thing, better living through electricity. Was that DuPont, Better Living, or Pfizer, Better Living Through Chemistry? It's one of those companies. But definitely, I've been like actually reviewing GE Electric like ads from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they really lay it on thick. GE ads are like the funnest to teach because they're so full of ideology. Like every GE ad is just awash in like this bright future, like that we bring good things to life. Or in the 50s, it's live electronically or something. It's like, and it's all about the life you can live, the ease of you'll have. These appliances are going to bring, you know, a greater life to you if you just buy our products. It's selling not just a product, it's selling a life of leisure. And I wonder if like Heinlein was I was watching ads from like 1956, 57 when this book was written. And maybe Heinlein literally saw these GE ads and got some of the ideas for this book from it, because that's the heart of it. It's like The Door into Summer is a future of leisure, of, you know, of labor saving work or labor saving technology, liberated from labor through tech. And I think that's the heart of it. And looking at the Wikipedia article for this, there's not that much really on this. Like, look at this, the themes. Time travel, post-apocalyptic, and then the romantic, the odd romantic. Okay, here it is. The romantic situation is interesting. The sexual interest of an engineer of 30 and a girl of 12. That culminates in a marriage that in which the cold sleep allows for the adjustment of their ages a little bit. Nothing about the labor-saving tech here. So is other people not noticing it? Because it's like a huge part of the story. And it's a huge part of this theme of The Door into Summer. If we go in the back of the book, now, of course, maybe you could say The Door into Summer is his relationship with her. But literally the last thing, for old Pete, this is the last paragraph of the book. For old Pete, I built a cath bathroom to use in bad weather. Automatic, self-replenishing, sanitary, and odorless. However, Pete, being a proper cat, prefers to go outside, and he has never given up his conviction that if you just try all the doors, that one of them is bound to be the door into summer. You know, I think he's right. Now, he's an engineer. He's talking about, like, building a bathtub that'll be easier to get into, a hydraulic bed. The whole end of the book is about his future inventions, and that's tied very directly to the door into summer concept. So I think that's what this book's ultimately about. The noise about time travel, it's just a device to tell this particular corporate intrigue narrative. The heart of this is celebration of the vacuum cleaner, essentially. That's what it is, right? And that's all his first invention was, right? Hired Girl, that's the name of their company. It's named after the first device he built, which is just a vacuum cleaner, an automated vacuum cleaner. It's like the little gizmos that people have running around their houses, the little circle things that pick up dirt, that automatic vacuum the room for you. Speaking of that, I should get one of those. My room's kind of gross. Anyways, maybe we can talk about this story in go through it chapter by chapter if I don't get too bored here. Chapter one, there's no names for these chapters, but Chapter one is rooted around his decision to go to the long sleep. We've met him after he's been basically kicked off of the company's board. You know, he's got a company with his fiancée Belle, who's kind of the villain of the story. Even her age is wrong. She's all sussy. She's got a past. She's not honest about it. She's just kind of a con artist of sorts. But she has part of the stock, so she has a seat on the essentially on the board. And then Miles and her conspire to kick him out because he doesn't want to release products before they're ready. He's a big believer. Our narrator, Davis, is a big believer that products need to be ready, where, you know, you can't rush them. And he's saying 5 years we'll have this like automated all-purpose house cleaning device. And Miles doesn't want to wait. He wants to rush it out like the Cybertruck, or rush it out before it's ready. So, you know, and make money quick. He doesn't want to, and I think they kind of want to go public and expand what they're doing. He's more conservative, and he's more of an engineer. He just wants to make this cool shit. and doesn't want to really think much about the business aspect, so they kick him off. He still has his stock, but that's where we pick up. And he's at a bar drinking scotch, and Pete is in a bag, and he drinks ginger ale, which is kind of cute. The cat stuff is great. I mean, obviously, Heinlein's a cat lover, and there's moments here where you know he knows cats, because he's not... Someone who doesn't know cats wouldn't have been this careful with how they write about cats. For instance, even that first paragraph where he says he had to make the cat door wide enough for Pete's whiskers, you know. Obviously, cats are flexible, but if you have a cat, you know they don't like going into, and they won't go into spaces less wide than their whiskers, because I think the whiskers are the size, because it's the size of a normal cat, so they know they can get through. Whiskers warn them about a space that's too small. So even if they could sort of squeeze through smaller spaces, they don't like to do that because their whiskers are sensitive. So if you're going to build a cat door, it has to be at least as wide as your whiskers. That's the thing. But if you're not a cat owner, you wouldn't know that kind of thing, or like how to hold the cat, or how to pet it, or how to approach it if you want to pet it. You can't pat a cat. You have to like stroke it. All these details show he's clearly a cat lover. But anyways, he's at this bar, hungover, he's getting this drink, and he's thinking about going into the cold sleep. He sees these insurance companies. That's another really cool aspect of this, is like the insurance companies take over the cold sleep, because they're essentially extensions of life insurance, right? So anyone who goes into the cold sleep, they have to pay for it, and they're betting on, will they survive long enough? You know, what happens to the investments? They take the companies. It seems the cold sleep is almost like an investment firm, a retirement account manager that also deals in cryogenics, right? Because you go into the cold sleep and then you give their assets over to the insurance company and they manage your portfolio and then the money you make from that portfolio management pays for the cold sleep. Pays for their fee to maintain you, but also they are making money. And if you die, you know, they have life insurance signed against you, and a certain number of them will die. It seems it's just a glorified insurance policy, kind of how like GM is a bank that finances the purchase of cars that just happens to make cars as well, the cars that people want to buy. So the real money for GM is GMAC, right? Or at least I heard that. Maybe it's not true. But anyways, he's thinking about that. And he makes the decision while drinking that he is going to go into the cold sleep. So he goes over to one of these insurance companies, and we get the whole setup explained to us in quite a lot of detail. This is a short novel, by the way. It's 170 pages, and a lot is kind of packed into it. The kind of cool concepts are packed into it. Now, I think the heart of this is about labor-saving technology, but these other things are kind of cool. The thought that he puts into what would be involved in actually cryogenics is something Philip Dick doesn't care about. He doesn't want to put the time into it. He does a similar thing in Crack in Space, where he has people putting themselves into essentially the cold sleep because the population is overcrowded and they have to wait to find other planets before they can wake people up and move them there. He doesn't care about like the financing of it. Heinlein does. Heinlein's interested in like stocks and how you transfer a stock to someone else and how would you rob someone of their stock and how you get someone off the board. We actually saw that in Citizen of the Galaxy 2, the question of like ownership in companies. He's all into that stuff. Philip Dick would be bored by those conversations, I think. Very different people. It's I know I compare him to Philip Dick all the time because that's the other person I did a series on. Sorry, I'm not as widely read in science fiction as some of you. Anyways, I just was kind of fascinated by how much detail we got in all of this. So he decides to do it. He puts down his down payment. He establishes the signs the contract and everything. So he's going to do that, and he's going to set up to do it tomorrow. He even has the doctor's appointment. And the doctor's like, I can tell you're drinking. You can't be drunk tomorrow, or I won't allow you to do that. He kind of ends up ignoring that advice, but anyways, that's what we get into. So then chapter two is Davis's entire history up to this point, and particularly the history of Hired Girl. So I think it's the longest chapter in the book. I want to say it is, but he gets his whole history of how he started this company with Miles Gentry. We get his history of his relationship with Ricky Frederica, who, as I said, was Miles' stepdaughter, but she's like 12 at the time. And there's definitely an affection he has for her established at this point. It's not, it actually is a little, you can kind of get a little bit of a creepy smell from him even at this stage. And the way Heinlein deals with this is by having her go into a cold sleep when she, you know, 8 years later when she's old enough, and then wake up still young and hot, but old enough to marry. It's like a bit, it is what it is, right? But it's this chapter, this past, is explored in detail, basically as a way to get us on board and understand why he chooses, instead of doing Into the Cold Sleep, to do revenge, to pursue a path of revenge against his former business partners. But the other big heart of this chapter is the technology, right? Is he says very clearly, and this is why I think this is the major theme of the book and should be acknowledged as such, is this isn't a time travel story that just happens to include labor-saving technology as its story. It's a story about labor-saving technology that just happens to use time travel. It's backwards in that way, the way maybe most people read this. Because that's his Dorn to Summer, is freeing us from household labor. And the fact that he focuses on household technologies means he's thinking about women. He's thinking about gender, Heinlein is. And I think his radicalism on gender issues is really put on the page here. Again, this is something Philip Dick wouldn't be bothered with. If anything, Philip Dick would be scared of this stuff. You know, he was not, when he thought of labor-saving technology, or when he thought of technology, he thought it was pretty much all bad. And a lot of his stories target even like household labor-saving technology in a negative way. Like Nanny is a good example of this, whereas like he saw that as something that's kind of intrusive in not a welcome presence in the home. But Heinlein's not going to have none of that. Heinlein is saying, and in fact, I think stories like Nanny were written before this, to be honest. Anyways, what was the last thing to go automatic, he writes. Answer any housewife's house. I didn't attempt to figure out a sensible scientific house. Women didn't want one. They simply wanted a better upholstered cave. But housewives were still complaining about the servant problem long after servants had gone the way of the mastodon. I rarely met a housewife who did not have a touch of slaveholder in her. They seemed to think they really ought to have strapping peasant girls grateful for the chance to scrub floors 14 hours a day and eat table scraps at wages a plumber's helper was scorned. That is why we called the monster Hired Girl. It brought back the thoughts of a semi-slave immigrant girl who grandma used to bully. Basically, it was just a better vacuum cleaner, and we planned to market it at a price competitive with ordinary suck brooms. So a little bit of weird politics there about like this idea that women want to have a slave to master. I don't know if I agree with that, but I certainly agree that labor-saving tech is liberating. He writes later on, Hired Girl Mark I was selling like beer at a ball game, and I was kept busy for a while improving it and setting up real assembly line and putting a shop master in charge, and I happily turned to thinking up more household gadgets. Amazingly little real thought had been given to housework, even though it is at least 50% of all the labor in the world. The women's magazines talked about labor saving in the home and functional kitchens, but it was just prattle. Their pretty pictures showed living working arrangements essentially no better than those of Shakespeare's day. The horse-to-jet plane revolution had not reached the home. I stuck to my conviction. Housewives were reactionaries. No machines for living, just gadgets to replace the extinct domestic servant. That is, for cleaning and cooking and baby tending. So that's what leads him to invent Window Willie, which is basically like a kind of a window vacuum cleaner that will crawl on your windows and do the job of maintaining those, of maintaining that part of the house. All right, anyways, that's my case for why this novel is really about about labor-saving technology, and that is the door into summer. It has nothing to do with time travel or anything like that, at least not primarily. So then we get the history of his relationship with Miles and Belle. Belle's like starts out as a secretary. He falls in love with her, gives her stock as an engagement present while hoping to maintain like voting shares, but it's like money. And that becomes a bit of a plot point. But eventually he develops this, you know, this new technology that's going to be like an all-purpose robot. Essentially, because these other things are just devices that are like automated. He wants to build an all-purpose robot that can like do all the household work. Flexible Frank, I think it's called, is what he's working on. And he and Belle and Miles say, no, we're going to put out the beta version and sell it and make a bunch of money. And he doesn't want to do that. So he gets pushed off the board. And fired, essentially, and kicked off the premises. Now, the question of the IP for this, again, this is stuff that, like, other writers maybe wouldn't be interested in, but certainly Heinlein is, like, the IP of this. Like, the legality of things like, you know, if you're working on Flexible Frank at night, it's not on company time, but did he work at all? Did he think about it on company time? Like, what's the contract actually saying? He didn't have a contract. They kind of imposed a contract on him later so they could fire him, you know, and get this IP. All of these are interesting questions that are like important to the plot, and you have to read it to kind of to appreciate all of it. But I like how it's done. Even like the legality of giving stock as an engagement gift and then them not getting married and the engagement being broken, like does that refund the stock initially? Like if I give someone an engagement present and then she doesn't marry me, do I, you know, usually you see in the movies they give the ring back, right? But is that a legal requirement to give the ring back? I don't even know. So anyways, chapter two is all the background of this. Now, in chapter three, we see Davis decides that he's going to confront Belle and Miles, and he decides he's not going to go into the cold sleep. So he still has the contract with the insurance company for the cold sleep, but he decides not to do it. He invents his automated drafting machine for engineers, which is like another labor saving technology for himself, which allows him to work more productively and more quickly. And a lot of the engineering stuff we get to in this chapter, the previous one, about like how memory circuits are stored in these devices and how you can program the robot to do different things. He talks about at one point making a secretary, but then you got to program it to speak language. He's really being pretty forward-thinking in this. There's actually even a discussion about art and essentially automated generation of art, what we call AI sometimes now. It's like kind of cool stuff. Again, I think that's the heart of the novel. But anyways, he decides at this point in the story that he's not going to go into cold freeze. And I forgot to mention Pete in all this. He takes the time. He says, I can't abandon Pete. I can't euthanize him. He's an old cat, but he's going to go into cold freeze with me. He's going to go into the cold sleep with me and wake up. But he even pays more for that. But he decides not to. And he confronts Belle and Miles, who have started a relationship together, so the betrayal is even deeper. And he's like, well, you know, I'm going to challenge you in court. At the very least, I can, like, tie you up, and I can, like, fight for my IP over this, over these other things I invented, and I have stock. I can fight this stuff out in the courts and ruin your life and ruin your business, and you're going down with me. And they're like, Belle in particular, who turns out here is like the mastermind and the criminal, says like, no, you're not. And they drug him. They use this zombie drug, which basically makes you conscious, but not able to move and helpless. And also you have to tell the truth. It's like a truth serum as well. He wakes up, and this is chapter four, and this is he's kidnapped. And eventually they try to get his stock. Now, what in the previous chapter, in chapter three, he had a plan to save the stock by sending it to a bank and having the bank sign it over to Frederica, who would keep it safe for him until he wakes up from the cold sleep. That's sort of his plan. Or at the very least, it won't be in Miles' hands or Belle's hands. He can keep that stock out of their control. But he's hoping to get it over to Frederica and maybe at some point back to him. So he writes this letter to Ricky and tries to set this all up. But anyways, he doesn't have the stock anymore. The stock's been like handed over to the care of a bank, so they won't be able to get it. They're trying to get it, though, in Chapter 4. They're trying to get his, you know, whatever they can from him. And then they finally decide, well, they find out that he's already got a contract for this cold sleep that he just hasn't, like, fulfilled yet. So they just take him over to the insurance company and throw him in the freezer. And that's it. So just so you know, we're 67 pages into 170, 180-page novel. And this is all just kind of, he hasn't even entered the cold sleep anymore. In fact, the time travel only enters in the last, like, 30 or 40 pages of the book. So most of the novel is just him going into the future. The resolution is very sudden and very rapid in this case, because which again tells me that's not his prime focus. His prime focus here is engineering, the engineering problem of how to save labor. So chapter 4, he wakes up from the sleep and he's in this future. And the future's different. We have like the clothes is different. Instead of buttons and zippers, we have something more like the Star Trek uniforms where it's sort of just a self-sealing. And this leads to different types of fashion styles. Obviously, he's behind on engineering, so he has to relearn that. You know, the city's names have changed. You know, it's not a huge change. It's not that he can't work his way back into the world. The year 2000, which is when he'd set in 1970 initially, and now it's the year 2000. It's a 30-year deep freeze he's in. It's not impossible for him to catch up. And one reason it's not hard for him is his devices have spread. His robots are around. And now he doesn't initially dig into this. He just thinks someone else invented it. Or maybe it was Hired Girl that invented it. Finds out later on that Hired Girl is kind of hard up because Miles died and Belle kind of ran the company a bit into the ground and there was competition from others. What's this competition? Jumping ahead a few chapters, he eventually finds out that his name is associated with it, or Ricky's name through her original name before she was the stepdaughter of Miles, right? Because her name was like Frederica Gantry after her stepfather, but her original name was, you know, different. And that was the name associated with like the patents and the company and stuff like that. So, he doesn't put it together because he doesn't have all the information, but it's all him, right? He is the one who did all this. He just didn't do it yet. It's something that he's going to do in his future, you know, his linear timeline's future, but it's actually going to happen in the past. He's going to go back in time and do all these things that have already been done. So it is a kind of a deterministic loop, but it's kind of done really well here with the cold freeze. I think the way Heinlein puts it together is well done, makes it a really absorbing novel. But again, the heart of it is this technology that's leading to concrete advances for humanity, right? We're in this age where we're all afraid of labor-saving technology. Now, I don't think much of AI. I basically think it's a grift. And all the predictions that it's going to, going to save labor are kind of overblown. I think it's kind of dumb, actually. But people smarter than me and people who know stuff have said, no, you're wrong. This in some applications is going to be super useful. My job is not very useful. It's not useful for teaching. It certainly gets in the way of teaching often. That said, I think technology does have this liberatory potential. And I think focusing on housework is a great example of that. The washing machine, is probably one of the most liberating technologies ever invented, because laundry day used to be a huge physical, emotional burden on women, right? Because they had to do it. And you had to clean the sheets and the towels and the clothes for the whole family by hand. rinse everything by hand, dry everything by hand through those rollers, and then, you know, hang everything up. Huge task, huge, huge job. And the washing machine and the dryer just made it like all you have to do is throw something in and take it out. And it's super, super liberatory. That's what technology should do. It should free us from drudgery. And I don't see AI doing that yet. You know, and obviously we don't have the robots that are being predicted here, but we have a bunch of appliances that make our life certainly easier in the home. Maybe that's one reason I'm attracted to these GE advertisements is like, they lay it on thick with the, we bring good things to life and all that, but are they wrong? Right? Like, I'm thinking of one of the 1980s, we bring good things to life. Ads has like a marriage ceremony, and then there's lights, and then a night out. And of course there's lights. And of course we see someone giving birth, or it's an ultrasound maybe, and it's connected to a GE ultrasound machine. You know, yeah, technology has helped reduce the deaths of women and babies in during pregnancy, right? More people are alive today because of these technologies. And it's made labor, literally labor, easier, right, for women. So these are all like really radically transformative technologies in a way. So, you know, maybe GE is okay to lay it on a little bit thick. They are selling a better life in a way. So I'm not as technophobic as maybe sometimes I come off. I just don't like stupid technologies. Give me a teaching robot that can liberate me to do more podcasts. That's what I'm hoping for. Anyways, I forget where I am. Chapter 5, he wakes up. We learn about the future. Chapter 6 is more of this, the changes taking place. Now, one of the big changes that's described here is overproduction. His first job he gets, he has no money. His money, now, in truth, he's not broke because he's actually, I guess, alive, right? There's an older version of him hanging around, right? I just, he never meets him. He never runs into him. But one of the big problems in economics is overproduction. So he's working at this like car salvage yard as his first job for like minimum wage. And these surplus cars are just being dumped. And he's asking like, why aren't they just being like repurposed or reused, the materials? And he's told like there's no market for it. Essentially, we're overproducing these cars. Quote, there's a simple matter of economics, son. These are surplus cars the government has accepted as security against price support loans. They're 2 years old now and can never be sold. So the government junks them and sells them back to the steel industry. You can't run a blast furnace just on ore. You have to have scrap iron as well. You ought to know that if you're a sleeper. Matter of fact, with high-grade ore so scarce, there's more and more demand for scrap. The steel industry needs these cars. End quote. So cars are being produced just for the scrap metal. Right, all the resources that go into making the car are like wasted because we're like, essentially it's post-scarcity, isn't it? It seems to be a post-scarcity situation. At least that's what we get on the surface here. Housing, though, not so much. Maybe there seems to be a shortage of housing that he has to work to. So there's a misallocation of resources here. So why that is, maybe we can break down. Maybe we can think about that. I'm not sure. I don't really have an answer for that. Maybe Heinlein is somewhat, on some level, blaming government policy for this misallocation of resources. But maybe it's just to build up drama for the character, that is something he has to deal with. But we learn about changes in women's fashion. We also learn about basic field theory, which allows things to be manipulated automatically. Some of these changes are going to be what allow him to take the steps he needs. He has to relearn the new engineering, or he has to learn the new engineering before he can make the robot that he's going to, of course, invent in the past that's going to lead to these advances that he sees around him, right? He's the one who creates these changes. He ends up getting a job at Hired Girl because why not? He wants to get revenge on Belle, of course. Miles died 2 years after the events in the early parts, back in 1972. So he dies in like 1972. But he does run into Belle Gentry, who is like, we see her in chapter 7, and just a brief meeting. where it's all revealed, you know, who he is to her. But she's in a tough spot. Like, she hasn't, the technology's available to stay young well into your 60s and even 80s, it seems, but she doesn't invest in this, so she looks just gross, which is kind of like what Dan Davis wanted initially. Is he wanted to, like, go in the future 30 years and still be young and her to be old and gross, and that would be revenge enough. And he does sort of get that, but he also learns that the company's not doing that well. It's hard up. So that's when we start to get into the investigation. And he's starting to investigate, like, especially Flexible Frank and Eager Beaver and these other technologies he invented and the prototypes and the patents. And it turns out that he has these patents. These patents are under his name or under the name under Daniel Davis what turns out to be Frederica's original name before she became Frederica Gentry. I forget it. It's slipping in my mind. I should have wrote it down. It's in here somewhere. I'm looking at the physical book in my marginal comments. We're also introduced to how the military has been studying this null grav, like this anti-grav kind of thing, which has a byproduct of allowing time travel, but it doesn't really have any practical applications yet. There's thoughts about military use for this, but he's got this. Oh, here it is. It's Frederica's name, Heinecke. Heinecke is the name that was originally Frederica's birth name. That's also all over the patents and things. So he's under, why is my name on these patents? Was it, how did this happen? Someone steal my identity? What's going on? Well, it turns out he's been doing it all along. He's in this timeline as well. Just there's an older version of him floating around, right? They actually established that they couldn't have met. Like, he says, like, that would have been a disaster. But anyways, chapter 9, he finds Frederica, who is still young and hot because she went into the cold sleep, and she's married now. So that's kind of a dead end for him. So he chooses not to kind of butt into her life. Instead, he goes and investigates this time travel thing, and he finds the inventor who invents it. And now we're getting really close to the end of the novel. There's only like 30 pages left at this point, where he figures out, he basically strong arms the guy into letting him use this technology on an experimental basis. He goes back into 1970, and it's really rushed, I think. Like, I don't know if Heinlein had a longer novel he could have written out of this. And I think the movie version, it's a Japanese version, does stretch out this part of the story a little bit, because there's a lot that could, interesting stuff that could have happened in this, but it's like he's just like, I got to finish this. You know, I had 3 issues. I think it was in the magazine of Science Fiction and Fantasy to write this. And I'm kind of running out of space. I think that's sort of what happened. Maybe the pacing, if we look at the original issues that it was published in, maybe it's a pacing issue that's tied to that aspect of it. But I remember when I read this a few years ago that I thought this was a little bit longer. This back to 1970 part is a little bit longer. But anyways, chapter 10, he does go back in time, and he can't, it's not precise 100% like location, and he ends up at, and also you don't know quite exactly what was in that place, that moment, at that space at that time. So they're even talking about, like, you could end up in a tree, right? Or something, if you don't know that there's not a tree there at this exact location. Anyways, he goes back. He ends up in a nudist resort, which is just a fun little Heinleinian, like, introduction. Like, we're just going to put naked people in. Are there naked people in Double Star? No, but there are in The Puppet Master. I made a big deal of that when I talked about that novel. It's like Heinlein wanted naked people in that story, and he wrote a whole novel about parasites in order to get a whole planet of naked people. Here is just a resort, a naturalist resort. But that's where he runs into. And then, he had gold he brought with him, and there's a whole subplot here crammed into the last few pages of the novel about how he has to sell the gold. But long story short, he, in the last couple chapters of this book, he sets up his company, he sets up his technologies, he sets up his business. Gets engaged to Frederica and goes back into the cold sleep, right? So when does he wake up? Does he wake up after? I assumed he woke up a little bit before his original wake-up time, because it's even talked about how there might have been two of them at one point, right? That's what I was referring to before, a slightly older version of himself. Yeah, not 30 years older, because he went back into the cold sleep, but a slightly older version of himself. But, you know, anyways, however it works, he's back in 2000. And why does he do that? Why doesn't he just, like, go back to 1970 and live out his life? Well, it's Frederica. It's Ricky. Ricky Tiki Tavi. He's got this cute little pen name for her. She's described as adorable, even as a young girl. So now let's, you know, talk about this again. The only reason I see for him to go back to the future, except thematically, the future is better because of technology, better living through electronics. Maybe that's kind of the reason we're given, but it's also he can't marry her when she's 12. He has to wait 8 years. So instead of waiting 8 years, he says, you wait 8 years. Don't meet anyone else. Don't have any high school boyfriends. Just wait until you're like old enough to marry, but are still hot. Go into the cold sleep then, and then wake up in 20 years or 22 years or whatever. And I'll be there. In fact, there might be two of us, but they'll be, yeah. So he is earlier because Frederica was married, right, when he's there. So it must have been married to him. I have this right. I'm not confused, I think. It's all really weird. It's like kind of creepy, actually. It's not so much that he's married, you know, he's attracted romantically to this 12-year-old, because that's not really in the text. He's romantically attracted to the 20-year-old he sees, but the way he kind of strong-arms her into doing everything he wants. He's taken this young girl who does like him and is friendly and doesn't have really anyone else in her life. You know, Miles is going to die at 2, and he's just a step-parent. Belle is a really bad mother figure. She really has nobody. And he's like, well, do this for me. I've pathed out the next 8 years of your life. And when you wake up, you can marry me. That's the weird part about it. It's weirder than him like setting up, engaging them, getting engaged to a 12-year-old. As weird as that is, it's the, not only am I engaged to you, I am dictating the next 8 years of your life and your future. And you're gonna have to go into the cold sleep, which is a non-zero risk of death. Now, you could say he's seen that she survives the cold sleep, so he knows she'll survive it again. It's a deterministic loop. Fine, but it's still like a risk, right? It's, you know, he doesn't really know how the rules of time travel work. He says that at one point later on too, that it's a little weird and it's not all worked out, which is why we shouldn't use it to go back in time, but going into the future, not as problematic. Anyways, I don't really have a take on this. I do think it's up there in kind of the weird things, but it's weirdest in his, for all his individualism. Like Heinlein kind of thinks this is a novel about the success of the hyper-competent individualist. He doesn't even want to be part of this corporation. At the end, rather than being a board member of the company, he's just the engineer working behind the scenes with stock. He doesn't want to be part of any institution. But he certainly wants Riki to commit herself to an institution of marriage. Now, asterisk here, marriages in the future in 2000 are contractual. They're two-year marriages, something that he believes apparently very strongly in, because he keeps bringing it up in stories where all the way back to For Us the Living, he had this idea of marriage as being essentially just contracts for a certain set period of time. I'm fine with that, but still, this relationship is probably the weirdest part of this book. And do you need it? No, I'm trying to remember how the Japanese movie version did. I think I kind of watched it with one eye, not very carefully, but I think they maybe raised the age of of Ricky a little bit. I don't know, but it's still the power dynamics here are the problematic aspect more than him creeping on a 12-year-old, which he does a little bit too. But it's, I mean, textually, he falls in love with, like, romantically with the 20-year-old version, but then he goes back and interacts with her as a 12-year-old and says, "Let's set up our marriage because you're going to be hot when you're 20." And that's it is what it is, but it's a bit cringy. So anyways, I've been going on a while about Door into Summer, and I think you know my thoughts about it, so I'm not going to say too much more. I really enjoyed this book. It was fun to reread it. Now, next we'll do Menace from Earth. Will be the next story, which is one of the last future history short stories that we have to read. I think some of the novels fit into the future history. Maybe Stranger in a Strangeland does. Certainly Moon is a Harsh Mistress does. So we're not done with it, but, you know, it hasn't been on our mind much lately, except sometimes I asked, does this juvenile fit into that in one way or another? Some of them definitely do, because Green Hills of Earth, the poem, are mentioned. But we'll do that. It'll actually be a couple episodes on a couple stories, and then we'll get into the last juvenile. I'll have Space Suit Will Travel, and then we'll see where that takes us after that. So anyways, I had a lot of fun with this novel. It was great to reread. It's a nice short read. I do encourage you to read this one if you haven't. It's a lot of fun. So anyways, that's going to be it for now. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.